Welcome to KUOW Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this episode, perhaps it shouldn't come as a surprise that the author of The Botany of Desire chose to experiment with and write about psychedelic drugs. They are edible, after all, but it is a bit surprising. Like many people, Michael Pollan wasn't exactly keen to fool around with mind-altering experiences. Curiosity about the history of these drugs led him to test their effects firsthand. His discoveries supported a view to the mind-expanding therapeutic potential of psychedelics. They led him to write his new book, How to Change Your Mind: What the New Science of Psychedelics Teaches Us About Consciousness, Dying, Addiction, Depression, and Transcendence. Michael Pollan teaches writing at Harvard and UC Berkeley. He is the author of 7 books, including The Omnivore's Dilemma. On the Seattle leg of his book tour, he was interviewed by Ingrid K. Walker, the author of High: Drugs, Desire, and a Nation of Users. Walker is an associate professor of American Studies at the University of Washington, Tacoma. This conversation took place on May 22nd at Seattle's Temple de Hirsch Sinai. Town Hall Seattle presented the discussion, recorded by KUOW's Jenny Cecil Moore. We're presenting our broadcast version here. To listen to the full event, go to kuow.org/speakersforum. Please note, this recording contains unedited language of an adult nature. Here, Town Hall's Ware Harmon introduces the event.
Michael Pollan has been at Town Hall, by my reckoning, 4 times, but this is the first time we've ever presented him Town Hall ourselves. So he's the author of 7 previous books, 5 of them, 2013's Cooked, Food Rules from 2009, 2008's In Defense of Food, The Omnivore's Dilemma, A Natural History in 4 Meals from 2006, and The Botany of Desire, A Plant's Eye View of the World. Those books share the distinction of all being New York Times bestsellers. He's a longtime contributor to the New York Times Magazine, and he teaches writing at Harvard and the University of California, Berkeley. In 2010, Time Magazine named him one of the 100 most influential people in the world. Ingrid K. Walker is Associate Professor of American Studies at the University of Washington, Tacoma. Her current research engages drug users about their experiences, developing a language to talk about drugs outside of the framework of medicalization or criminalization. Her writing has been published in the Journal of Popular Culture, Nano, publications of the Alcohol, Drug, and History Association, and other industry publications. She's the author of High: Drugs, Desire, and a Nation of Users. I'm not high, by the way. I just went up on my line there. Sorry. High: Drugs, Desire, and a Nation of Users, which was published in 2017. Michael's book is called How to Change Your Mind: What the New Science of Psychedelics Teaches Us About Consciousness, Dying, Addiction, Depression, and Transcendence. And it's the occasion for the conversation tonight. Please join me in welcoming Ingrid K. Walker and Michael Pollan.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Good evening. Thank you for being here. I want to share a personal moment because 15 years ago, I started on my book project. It was a forever project. I'm not as fast as he is, because I read The Botany of Desire, and it was revolutionary in terms of thinking about, yes, we should be talking about desire when we talk about drugs. So it's such a pleasure to be here with you tonight and to come full circle.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
It's really great. I am super excited about How to Change Your Mind. I got an advanced copy. I've read it. And I just want to say it's a spectacular read because you've populated this history of the first wave and second wave of psychedelic research with these fascinating characters. And they are funny, and they are fun, and they are curious. And so I think you're going to really love the book. But the thing that you did that I think is so important is you went there. You decided to be a participant observer, which I'm a cultural studies scholar, and that's a really important piece of work in my field, to not think that you can be objective about something, that you have a stake in what you're writing about. Yeah. So I really appreciate that you put yourself inside the study.
Well, there was no question that that I would do that. I mean, it's kind of, for a lot of reasons. One is, the psychedelic experience is very hard to understand from the outside.
Yeah.
And I was hearing things from these volunteers and patients in these drug trials who were getting psilocybin, which is the ingredient in magic mushrooms. And what they were telling me was so implausible. These transformations in their worldview after a single session. Then I felt I couldn't explain it without having the experience myself.
Yeah.
And then there's the fact that that's how I do journalism. You know, when I was writing about the cattle industry for Omnivore's Dilemma, I bought a steer. And when I was writing about architecture in a place of my own, I built a house and learned how to bake and make cheese. And I mean, this is what I do. And it's kind of, and it's what I love about journalism is that you can find a place to write about something from inside that conveys a sense of wonder and first sight, fresh seeing that you can't get either as someone who's very experienced or someone who's totally inexperienced.
Yeah.
So it was there was never a question that I would do that.
So
although I was very afraid of doing it, I have to say.
Which is really part of the narrative, and it's threaded through the book really elegantly.
Reluctance. It's a very important theme.
Honesty. I would say honesty. So I think culturally we suffer from a lot of misinformation about drugs and users and drug use. Criminalization has been really effective for 50 years in creating a lot of misinformation. So it's just so great. I'm out as a user in my work, and I think more people should be if they are users, because I think it normalizes it. And so you normalize it.
Well, it's interesting. I found that, you know, I had a lot of trepidations, I mean, at every stage, but including publishing this book, where I do talk about these experiences I had. And I've been going on national television and national radio, and I didn't know how people were going to deal with that. But I found something that I should have known, but that if you can speak about this in a very matter-of-fact way, people respond in a matter-of-fact way. And you remove some of the stigma attached. So I found that it is possible to have a pretty normalized conversation where you're just looking at these, okay, let's leave aside all the moralism and even the legal questions. And what kind of tool is this? Is this a good tool? Can this heal people? Is it how safe, how dangerous? You know, let's just like have a sane conversation as if it were a legal drug. And I've been really heartened by the fact that there's, from my limited sample, this book's been out for a week, that there's, so, you know, things could change next week and the police could show up. But thus far, I've been very heartened by the fact that, you know, maybe we are ready to have a new kind of conversation.
I think we are. And I'm grateful. In fact, today I was talking about a colleague we know, Ismail Ali, who's an attorney for MAPS, the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Study. And he was talking about that as he goes around the country, he's realizing that people are more receptive, and possibly it's because of need, which I think you talked about quite a bit.
I think that that's very important. The fact is that one of the things I learned in the course of researching this book is that mental health care in this country is really broken. It only reaches about half the people who need it. Rates of depression, suicide, addiction are all soaring. People are suffering, and we have very few tools for them. The last big innovation in mental health care is the introduction of the SSRI antidepressants, and that takes you back to, I think, 1986 or 7. And since then, there's been very little innovation. So one of the things that surprised me is even the psychiatric establishment has been very curious and interested in this research to see whether psychedelic drugs, which were researched very closely in the 50s, there was a very promising period of research long before the 60s explosion that showed that they may have something to offer us, and then it was suppressed. And we had 30 years where nothing happened in this research. And now there's a renaissance. It's being revived. So there's reason to be, you know, guardedly hopeful.
Well, and I think one of the interesting parallel developments, and you allude to this at several points, is that just as, so all this promising research happens in the 50s, which we'll talk about in a moment, very effective. The efficacy of the early studies was off the hook and almost unbelievable. And then people were so exuberant about the drugs that it started to seem not possible.
Well, that's
possible.
An occupational hazard, over-exuberance around psychedelics. There's something about them, and you end up Timothy Leary. You get turned into an evangelist. And I'm working very hard not to do
that. You're keeping a straight face. I think you're smiling more, I'm just going to say. But I think the thing that's interesting is that so the American Psychological Association kind of really, I write about this in my book, they went toward those pharmacological solutions and turned away from this, but now we're seeing that the efficacy of those drugs is not what we thought it was over long term, right? So it makes sense that
culture... Well, yeah, I mean, the SSRIs, there was just a big meta-analysis that found that they only work slightly better than placebos. I'm sorry if I'm ruining your SSRI for you. And that people, you know, and that their effect fades over time, and that's why people are switched from one to another. And that they're hard to get off, and they have a lot of side effects people don't like. They're not a great tool. It's what we have. I think that the door is open.
Do you want to, since we're talking about the lack of efficacy there, do you want to talk a little bit about some of the studies and what's been found most recently?
Yeah, I mean, I should describe this a little bit about what is this research and how I got into it, because you probably know me as someone who writes about food, and although mushrooms apply in both stories, different kinds of mushrooms. So the research that caught my eye, and this is in 2010, was a study where researchers at NYU and Johns Hopkins were giving psilocybin, the ingredient in magic mushrooms, to cancer patients, people with terminal diagnoses or very serious diagnoses, to help them deal with what the researchers called their existential distress, the fear, anxiety, and depression that can accompany a cancer diagnosis. And that seemed really bizarre to me. I can't imagine myself faced with that diagnosis that I would want to trip. That it seemed like that loss of control and the fact that you would no doubt end up dwelling on your death, it all seemed terrifying. So I decided I wanted to look into it, and I began interviewing people in these trials, both at NYU and Hopkins, and I heard the most astonishing stories from them. They would have a single psychedelic trip. And I should explain how it happens, because the image in your head of a psychedelic trip is like, maybe, if you have an image in your head, it's kids taking a handful of mushrooms and going to a concert, or taking a tab of acid and walking around the woods. But this is very different. This is a guided, highly controlled administration of the drug. And it's not just an administration of the drug. One of the things that's novel about this is... it joins talking therapy to pharmacology in a way that we haven't done very much in the past. So you're working with a guide. In fact, in these above-ground trials, two guides, a man and a woman usually, and they prepare you in a series of sessions for what to expect. And they tell you what to do if it gets really scary, if it takes a dark turn. And most of their advice revolves around the idea of surrendering to what's happening, and that people get into these panic reactions or paranoia when they're resisting things like the utter dissolution of your sense of self, which can be scary. And I understand that. But if you surrender to that, it can be quite blissful, actually. And so they tell you things like, if you see a staircase, climb up it. If you see a door, open it. If you see a path to the basement, go into the basement. If you see a monster, step right up to it and say, what are you doing in my mind? Don't try to run away. Relax your mind and float downstream. They often quote John Lennon. So that's part of it. And then they also ask you to set an intention. Do you want to confront your mortality and think about that? Do you want to work on your addiction or some habit? Or do you just want to learn something about your mind? And the intention, since the drugs are so heavily influenced by set and setting, that is, your inner and outer environment when you're taking them, and that's something very unusual. It's true of all drugs to some extent, but it's particularly true of psychedelics. The expectations with which you approach the experience will often shape it. And so then during the experience, you're given a pill, or if you're doing it with a mushroom, you'd get a certain quantity of dried mushrooms. And they sit with you the whole time. They say very little. But they're there. They're kind of like ground control, you know, while you're out wandering in space, they're looking out for your body. And so you can feel safe. And it's really important to feel safe in order to surrender, right? Because one of the things that happens, and we can talk more about this, is that your defenses are lowered or even eliminated. So you're in a very vulnerable space psychologically. And you'll only do that if you're really safe. You feel physically safe and psychologically safe. And that's what a good guide does. And it takes a lot of training to get good at this. Then after the experience, so during the experience, if you get really upset, they'll hold your hand or help you get a glass of water or take you to the bathroom. And it goes on for about 6 hours. And one of the reasons they use psilocybin and not LSD, which would work similarly, there are two main reasons. One is it's a shorter trip on psilocybin and the therapist can get home for dinner. And LSD can go on for 12 hours, so it's more than a shift for any caregiver. And the other is, of course, LSD has so much more political and cultural baggage. There, so few people know the word psilocybin. You know, many people don't know how to pronounce it. So it's hard to imagine that congressman standing up and railing about the fact that we're giving psilocybin to our cancer patients. Whereas LSD, they could make some hay out of. So then after the experience, you come back for what is called an integration session. And the guides have you tell the story of what happened, and you try to make sense of it because it can be very confusing sometimes, and underline themes that are perhaps important. This is where just being a good therapist comes in, and also figure out how can you apply what you saw or learned to the conduct of your life. What can you take forward from it? Because obviously you're not going to remain in a psychedelic state. So that's the guided. Treatment. And the effects on people were remarkable. Not in all cases, but in something like 80% of the cases, people had statistically significant reductions in standard measures of anxiety and depression. An effect size, this is one of the ways you measure the effectiveness of a drug, but an effect size that was off the charts. And, you know, one of the psychiatrists involved said, I've never seen a psychiatric intervention like this. So then the question being, well, what happened? How did this work? And I'll just tell you one story, a quick story, to give you a sense of the kinds of experiences people have. There was a woman I interviewed named Dinah Baser, and she was 60, 60, 61. She was a figure skating instructor in New York City. And she had ovarian cancer, and she was treated successfully, but the fear of recurrence was so debilitating to her. She was truly paralyzed. She could not go about her life. She just was afraid she had this thing in her, and it was going to come back, and she was going to die. And so she heard about this trial at NYU, and she enrolled, and she had a guided trip, and she went into her body in the trip, imaginatively, and she saw this black mass under her rib cage. So it wasn't her cancer, she realized. But she realized what it was. It was her fear. And there it was. And she's a very timorous woman, very timid woman, and small. And nevertheless, when she saw it, she screamed out loud, "Get the fuck out of my body." And, you know, the therapists are like, whoa. Because they didn't know where she was or what happened. And they thought maybe she was talking to her cancer, but she was talking to her fear. And she said the fear vanished. And I wrote about this in this first piece I did called The Trip Treatment in The New Yorker. And I said in the Weasley way of journalist, you know, her fear of death was substantially diminished or something like that. And The New Yorker fact checkers, who are famously, you know, zealous, they called her and they said, "Is this true? Was your fear of death substantially diminished?" And she said, "No, that's completely wrong. It was extinguished. It was eliminated. She had no more fear of death." And she told me, she said, "I understood for the first time that I can't control the cancer, but I can control my fear." And that was such an empowering idea for her. And that points to one of the interesting qualities of this experience, which is that the insights you have, whether profound or banal, have an authority. They're not just opinions or ideas, they're like revealed truths This is a quality that William James wrote about over 100 years ago. He called it the noetic quality of this, the mystical experience. And you can act on these beliefs. And so that's the kind of thing I was seeing, and became intensely curious to have such an experience myself. But it was wonderful to see these people who were really up against it getting this kind of relief. And I talked to many, and some had, you know, miraculous changes, died with equanimity. One person I profiled in particular had a remarkable death that he directly attributed to this experience. And others were, you know, their fear and depression were not eliminated necessarily, but reduced. So it was a very, these results were just published a year ago. And so it's that kind of thing. And the same treatment is being used for people with addictions. There's a really interesting study of smoking at Johns Hopkins and alcohol addiction at NYU. And there will be soon studies for depression in the larger population, precisely because such a strong signal was seen in this particular group. So it's a very exciting line of research, and it's being pursued, by the way, without any help from the pharmaceutical industry, which doesn't see a way to make money from this, because these drugs are... there's no intellectual property to control, right? I mean, psilocybin grows all over the state, and LSD has been out of patent for a very long time. So the pharmaceutical industry wants drugs they can sell you every day, not something you take once. There's no business model there. But a lot of private contributions are supporting the work, which is exciting.
And I'll mention, just as a sidebar, the MAPS, which I mentioned earlier, the organization that studies psychedelics, they are at phase 3 study with FDA, PTSD studies with MDMA. So that'll probably be the first one that's a treatment that's available, and it's had the same remarkable set of effects that you write about.
Some people call it a psychedelic, some people not. It's ecstasy or Molly, which was used as a drug in therapy until it became a club drug, and then it was banned in 85. And they're using that to treat people, veterans and victims of sexual abuse for trauma, and they're also getting remarkable results. Like two-thirds of the people treated have shown significant reductions, and some they no longer qualify as having PTSD after, in that case, three experiences. So it's very exciting that we have these tools, yet they're still shrouded in stigma, a lot of which, you know, was established in the 60s. And that historical experience still colors, I think, how most of us approach these drugs.
And I think it colors a cultural anxiety and fear about them, because, and you talk about this quite a lot in the book, about growing up during the moral panic of psychedelics, and one of the reasons that you were just like, I'll pass, thank you. And I want to talk about that a little bit, because I think one of the things that we know now is that a lot of the bad trips that were there, well, I mean, if you think about the CIA and MKUltra, it's like understandable why those are bad trips, because they were creating them on purpose and dosing people without their knowledge and giving them extremely high doses, which would be terrifying.
The CIA had an idea when LSD was discovered to weaponize it, essentially, and use it as a truth serum. That didn't work very well. I mean, anyone could have told them that. And then as something to, you know, as a mind control agent, which we don't know how well that worked. It may have worked well, we don't know. And then also as something to embarrass world leaders, you know, put it in their coffee, and they would do silly things. And it was a horrible program, because they did dose a lot of people without their permission. Some people died. And we still don't know the full extent of that research program. So that was the shadow research program going on while all this research to help people was going on.
And successfully in achieving results. Well, I want to come back to this. So I wanted to mention the sort of the disinformation campaigns and also the real bad trips that people were having in the 60s, creating this environment where people were either really afraid of psychedelics and just shied away, or some people used them. And as you said, once you use them, you kind of have an experience. It's ineffable. It's difficult to talk about. And certainly hard to quantify or measure in any way. And so it becomes something that's personal, or at least known among a bunch of users. But I want to use that to talk about something you do in the book, which I think is so interesting. So you're curious. you're intrigued, you're watching these people have these results, you're hearing them talk about this, and you keep asking them, but was it an authentic experience?
Yeah.
and how can they say? They're like, I don't know, it was what I experienced, right? And so you're looking for a certitude almost.
Yeah.
And the place you went for that certitude, I thought, in terms of thinking about consciousness and having a conscious experience, was science.
Yeah.
And I want to talk about that choice a little bit, because I think it's very interesting, as you pointed out a minute ago, that you have a molecule, right, that changes something, and it's material intervention. You take this thing and it changes you. But in the therapy, it's really the talking through and working through what you saw that achieves results for people.
It's the psychological experience, yes. It's occasioned by a molecule, but the therapeutic agent is the kind of experience you have.
Right.
And that's an unusual, that's hard to fit into our paradigms too. So in other words, some people take the drug and they have an interesting trip, but it's not a mystical experience. And that's kind of what the gold standard is, at least in the American research. Now, what do we mean by that? Well, we mean this experience that William James wrote about a lot, and he's kind of the grandfather of our understanding of that. But it's another way to look at it that's a little less religious sounding is that it's a dissolution of ego. And when your ego dissolves, the barriers that the ego creates, the ego kind of patrols boundaries between subject and object, you and other people, you and nature, you and your subconscious feelings. That's the function of the ego, if we want to put it in more psychodynamic terms. When those walls come down and the defenses come down, there's an experience of merging with some larger entity, which might be other people in this, you know, wash of love, or it might be nature, or it might be the divine or the universe. And that feeling is what is often called a mystical experience. And people have had it through other means, and some people have it spontaneously. I mean, the history of religious literature, you know, contains many of these experiences. And that having that experience seems to be the best predictor of success. And that's interesting in itself, the idea that perhaps the ego stands in the way of healing. And because it's the ego that traps us in these stories we tell ourselves, that, you know, I can't get through the next hour without a cigarette. I'm unworthy of love. You know, we have these stories we tell ourselves, and they get in our way. And it is very often the ego who's enforcing those loops, those ruminative loops. So we're essentially prescribing a certain kind of very powerful and transformative experience. I mean, people who have mystical experiences for other reasons, it's a conversion experience. They come out a different place than they went in. And these drugs can fairly reliably, in something like 67% of cases, 70% of cases, can occasion a mystical experience. And of course, shrinks being shrinks, they have a measurement, you know, they have a scale that I filled out to see if I'd had one. It's called the MEQ, the Mystical Experience Questionnaire. It's kind of crazy, but, you know, they have to do this. They have to quantify everything. But I did go to science because, I was troubled by the fact that, okay, these people were having, speaking of the cancer patients, they were having experiences that acquainted them with another kind of plane of consciousness that they had never known before. And this plane of consciousness seemed transpersonal, to go beyond the confines of their own skull. It was somehow out there. And for some of them, that was very comforting, that there was some sort of consciousness, a larger consciousness, that they would be folded into after their death. And some of them had a very specific sense of an afterlife, or they saw something beyond that they could move toward or not at that point. And many of them chose to stay on this side. Others had a naturalistic understanding of that larger entity. This one woman described entering into the soil and passing through the soil and being taken up by the plants. Now, you could argue that's mystical, or that's what happens. Right? I mean, I didn't know how, and I would ask the researchers, like, well, are you concerned that you're just kind of fostering an illusion or a delusion in people who are dying? And I got a variety of answers. One was, that's above my pay grade. We don't really know what happens. Sort of a cop-out, but okay. Another was, who cares? Who cares? I mean, that if this is so profoundly comforting that it makes it easier for people to die, great. This is in their own head, right? They've come to this on their own. It isn't contained in the molecule. And, you know, so I was, you know, that was something I chewed on actually for a long time until I had my own experience. And then I kind of had a little more idea what they were seeing.
And even after, so you talk about different experiences throughout the book, which I won't ruin for you because I think it's lovely the way it unfolds. But even when you get to a place of some sort of pattern with this, you're like, okay, I think I know this experience somewhat now, right? It's not just a one-off. And I'm not sure what that was a response to. The one-off. I thought it was so interesting that you wanted then to think about consciousness. So then it was like, I want to understand what is happening to me. So most of the people, they have this conversion experience or this transcendental experience, or they come to know themselves and relinquish something that's been troubling them, and then they feel blissed out and happy, but not you. You had to go find the science, and you went to neuroscience, yeah. and you really went down, I think, a really fascinating rabbit hole. So I wonder if you would talk a little bit about what you discovered through consciousness.
Well, yeah, I mean, I was very curious to know what was happening in my brain. How was this working? What was going on? What do we know about it? And so I did kind of a deep dive into the neuroscience, and I found some researchers in England who were doing really incredible work. And I think one of the most telling things they found is that they started doing brain imaging, fMRI and another technique, of people's brains during the psychedelic experience. They would actually inject someone with psilocybin and then slide them into that MRI machine.
God.
I can't imagine it. Those volunteers should be thanked. And they what they expected to see was lots of, you know, increase in brain activity that would correlate with the fireworks that people experience and report, you know, hallucinations, synesthesia, all these kind of things that happen, and hearing voices. And but they found something very different, which was that one particular brain network called the default mode network, and I'll tell you a little bit about it in a second, was down-regulated, was activity went down, and that was kind of a surprise. Now, what does the default mode network do? Well, it has several different nodes. Several of which are in the cortex, which is the evolutionarily most recent part of your brain. But they also link to the to deeper, older centers of emotion and memory. And it's a hub in the brain. Lots of traffic passes through the default mode network. But we know it's specifically involved in a couple functions, most having to do with generating our sense of self. So self-reflection and rumination takes place here. Worry, mind wandering takes place here. Theory of mind, the ability to impute a mental state to another. Time travel, the ability to think about the past or the future. And something called the experiential or autobiographical self seems to be generated here. That's the very critical brain activity of or mind activity of taking information in, things happen to you, and connecting it to the story you tell about who you are. And it's how you develop that, I mean, which is, you know, based on your past, and that's why time travel is very important to this, and your future objectives. So these stories we tell to give ourselves a sense of a consistent self over time all takes place here. And it's no wonder then that when the scientists observed the sharpest drop in activity in the default mode network was when people reported, when they asked them what's going on, they would say, I have no sense of self. I've lost my sense of self completely. This part of the brain is also, you know, so if the ego has an address, it's the default mode network. And the fact that we now can turn it off pretty reliably with a drug is pretty astonishing. By the way, the same thing happens in very experienced meditators. If you image their brains and get them to, these are people with 10,000 hours of meditation. If you put them in an fMRI machine and they meditate for you, their brains look very similar. And of course, they're transcending self too. And one therapist called this in the 50s, this is, he called it therapy by self-transcendence. And it suggests that we get in our own way. Our egos get in our own way. And that those stories that we tell ourselves about who we are and get stuck with sometimes need to be suspended for a period of time. And you get a break from them. And that shows you that there might be another way to approach life.
Absolutely. And I think one of the interesting things about thinking about this for me is that this is not new. There are cultures that have used sacrament and ritual and done similar things. And if it's part of your culture, you might be less likely to have that ego get in your way along the way if this is a part of the way of thinking that you do as a culture.
But you could also argue that the ego is more pronounced in our culture than some other cultures, right?
I would never bet against you.
Yeah. And that we do. We erect walls. We objectify the other, whether it's other humans in our tribalism, or we objectify nature in a way that, you know, we don't give it the same credit for being a subject, for having any kind of agency. So therefore, we can do whatever we want with it. And so, I mean, I think this is a particularly Western ailment.
Absolutely.
That these drugs appear to address.
And the privileging of the self that happens in our culture, or the sort of self-orientation or self-obsession, whatever you want to call it, really is mitigated against by the psychedelic experience,
yeah.
Which is something I want to ask you about. So in your experiences, what happened to the self?
Well, I had several different experiences. I had an unguided experience with psilocybin, then I had guided experiences with LSD, a high-dose psilocybin, ayahuasca on a couple occasions, which is an Amazonian tea made from two plants. It contains DMT, which is a powerful psychedelic, and a really weird one called 5-MeO-DMT, which is the smoked venom of the Sonoran Desert toad.
He went there, no joke, all the way.
But, you know, a fellow human figured this out. Right? That's pretty amazing. You know, we always talk about it. Who's the first person who eat an oyster or a lobster? Who's the first person who figured out this toad venom? I've got to smoke it. That was not a good trip. But if we want to talk about ego dissolution, it was this guided psilocybin trip, which was, I think, the most profound for me. I was working with a woman who was wonderful, and I really had a sense of trust, even though she was very kind of woo-woo, new-agey for me. There was just something about her. She was really, you know, I mean, you know, when you're choosing therapists, whatever their system is, finally doesn't matter. It's like the bond, right? And I had this with her. And I wanted to mimic the kind of dose being used in these above-ground trials. I was working with an underground therapist. There is a thriving community of these people, I learned, in many parts of the country. And they are therapists, many of them. Some of them are MDs, some of them are PhDs, you know, psychologists, who are working with these drugs because they think that they're very powerful healing agents, and they're not deterred by the fact that it's illegal. I found them to be, most of them, there was a couple I met that I would not entrust my mind to. very mystical people. But they, you know, they're very professional. They have a code of conduct. They have you fill out lots of questionnaires the way a doctor would. They're actually even more careful than a lot of doctors. As one of them told me, we don't have very good insurance. So we're very careful. And they screen people very carefully. And anyway, so Mary, as I call her in the book, I did this guided psilocybin journey, and it had many chapters, and not all of them were pleasant. Initially, when we started, she started playing this piece of music by a guy named Thierry David, who I didn't know. It's a New Age composer, thrice nominated in the category of Best Chill Groove Album. And it was horrible, the kind of music you might hear during a massage. And I thought it was electronica, and it's some in this computer world. And I was deep in this. It was like a video game. Everything was generated. The music, I mean, synesthesia, you know, music generates space. You start seeing notes. And the world I was seeing was kind of dark and really, it wasn't scary, but it was just, I wanted to be outside, you know. I wanted better imagery. And I got stuck there for a very long time. And I could tell you why later. I figured out why I was in computer land. at a certain point, I was starting to get some anxiety, and I had this, I felt this tide rising of, like, I'm stuck in computer world. How can I get out? And so I decided to stop, and I didn't tell you this. During the guided trip, you're wearing eye shades, okay, and you're listening to music. And the eye shades are designed to make you go inside and not just kind of groove on, you know, the imagery that's out there. And it's very important if you're going to have a therapeutic trip. But as soon as you take off the eye shades, it sort of breaks the spell. And you can, and I did, because I just really wanted to make sure reality was still existing. And I had this moment of, walls, windows, plants. And I also had to pee, and she walked me to the bathroom across this loft, and I was very careful not to look in the mirror. I didn't know what I would see. And as I said in the book, I produced this spectacular crop of diamonds. She said I was honest. And then I went back, and I was going to resume, and Mary said, would you like a booster? Would you like some more? And I said yes, because I decided to go wherever she took me. And I had this, she was kneeling next to me. I was on this futon, and she's normally blonde, and she was like, I don't know, my age or a little bit younger. And I looked at her, and she's kneeling, and she's holding out in her hands this mushroom for me to take. And she had turned into a Mexican Indian, specifically someone named Maria Sabina, who was a legendary person in the world of psilocybin, because she was a Mazatec Indian who gave the first Westerner, a New York banker named R. Gordon Wasson, the first psilocybin trip that any Westerner had in 1955, and I'd studied that whole episode, and she is this legendary figure, and there she was. And she had this kind of leathery skin over these high cheekbones and this black hair part in the middle, and she's wearing a white peasant dress. And her hand is just, you know, really old, and there's this mushroom, and I was like, I didn't think I should tell Mary what happened to her. And then I went back under, and that's when it got really interesting. For a while, I'm experiencing this place as my usual self with my usual attitudes. I hate the music. And I have my usual eye, my perspective. And then suddenly, I felt my sense of self fall apart. And it was just kind of exploded into this sheaf of little papers like Post-its. But I was fine with it. Now, what's this other eye that was fine with it? I don't know. I mean, there was a kind of split in my consciousness between myself, which I could see, and this other perceiving consciousness. I know how crazy this sounds. And then I looked out. So I had no desire to pile the slips of paper back together and reassemble myself. I didn't fight it because I'd been instructed not to. But you could see why you might want to try to do that and why that would make you crazy. And then I looked out again, and I saw myself spread over the landscape like a coat of paint. And again, the perspective from which I was observing this was so disinterested, so calm and unburdened, it was just fine. And I think it was that consciousness that didn't feel like mine, it felt like more universal, but I had access to it, is the consciousness that a lot of the people who were dying felt and had access to. And that it's a consciousness in which whatever happens is meant to happen. You know, it's very fatalistic, very resigned, but not in a sad way. It had very, very little emotional tone to it. Anyway, it was to have your ego dissolve like that. I'd never had an experience like that. I'd never had a spiritual experience. And I think this was a kind of spiritual experience. And then it went on, and there was, I was still together enough to argue with her about the music, and I don't know which I did that, but we finally agreed to put on a piece of music by Bach, one of the unaccompanied cello suites, played by Yo-Yo Ma. It's number 2 in D minor. It's a spectacular piece of music. You probably heard it at funerals. That's where it's often played. And I had the most profound experience of music I'd ever had. I just merged with the notes. I merged with the strings. I could feel the horsehair of the bow just passing through me and went into the well of space in the cello itself and was completely at one with it. It wasn't music. It was something closer to the meaning of life. I mean, it was a very powerful experience. And hard to describe, obviously. And I worked very hard to describe it in the book. And I hope I succeeded. But it's not easy, because another mark of the mystical experience is that it's ineffable. And this certainly is. But it was very powerful. And so then in my integration, I tried to make sense of this. And I told Mary what had happened. And I said I'd had this experience of another way to be that wasn't, I mean, I'd always, like most of us, I identified with my ego. That was me, right? That voice in your head chattering and telling you what to do. And the ego is great, you know, the ego is very important. It got this book written. got a lot of us here tonight. But I was free of it for a period of time, and I realized it's not the only perspective on my life or on life. But I said to Mary, I said, but look, my ego is back in uniform and on patrol again. So what was gained? And she said, well, you've had a taste of another way to react or not react, less defensively, less self-interestedly, and that you can cultivate that, having seen what it was like. And I asked her how, and she said, well, meditate. Meditation is a very good way to connect with that kind of consciousness, because it is very similar to the consciousness that when you succeed, and I know you're not supposed to use that word talking about meditation, but when you reach that point of quieting your mind, there is this sense, and entering the present moment, there is a sense that the self disappears. And of course, the self can only exist in a continuum of past and future. So if you can really enter the present, the self goes away. And it's liberating. So I don't mean to knock the ego. I mean, you know, it's good for certain things. But it also does get in our way. So yeah. I think that was the most kind of the experience that was most transformative for me. And, you know, I could have gotten that insight about the ego from 10 or 20 years of psychotherapy, perhaps. That's one of the things you work on, right, in psychotherapy. But I got it in an afternoon. It's kind of amazing.
It is amazing. And so I think one of the things that was really compelling for me about the book is, so I used psychedelics as I came of age, so they're very much a part of my sense of self. So I can't imagine what it would be like at midlife to say, now I'm going to try this thing that I'm a little nervous about. And then to have that radical experience at that point in life.
Yeah.
It seems, and it's one of the things that you talk about, which I think is really important to understand, is so much of that self-understanding or that new perspective or that differentiated sense of self lasts.
Yeah.
You know, it might quiet down a little bit, and you might need to
access it elsewhere. There is part of the experience that has a residue. Part of it is, though, you keep going back to it, and you remember it. And so there's some new mental connection that you're exercising by remembering it. And I had images like that I replay in my head, and they become stronger and stronger. That's what learning is, right?
When
you do it in life, I there's a line in the book that's sort of a throwaway, but I really mean it, that psychedelics are wasted on the young. They may be, because
hey.
When... I know it's a little harsh, but I don't know the value of ego dissolution when you're 16, when your ego is still forming. There are other things that happen in that experience, and I really do think... Let me put it this way. There's a different kind of psychedelic experience when you're in your 50s or 60s than there is when you're a teenager. And I wish I hope you'll experiment, because you can help us understand the difference, because many people either had those early experiences or these later experiences, but few people do both, which is interesting.
Some of us continue all the way along.
But
I mentioned this because
I need a comparative perspective on this.
Yeah, we'll have to do a study. I think the interesting thing about it for me was it seemed like there's a lot to overcome if you haven't done it yet.
Fear. I had sleepless nights. Yeah. Every time I had a sleepless night before I did this, where I was like, one half of me was saying, are you crazy? You're going to go up on the mountain with this guy you barely know. If, you know, he doesn't even have a Wi-Fi connection, and he's, and like, what if you have a heart attack? Is he going to call 911, you know, and risk his own freedom? That's crazy. You know, you have a mortgage, you have a child, you know. And then the other half is like, but aren't you curious? You've never had a spiritual experience, and here's an opportunity, and you've got a book to write, and you need the scene. And finally, every time when I finally passed the point of no return and put the blotter paper on my tongue or whatever it was, I was able to surrender. And I realized later that that was my ego talking, trying to get me not to do this. My ego knew full well the assault that I was about to mount on him. And of course, our egos command our most rational faculty, so they have really good arguments. But sometimes they need to be ignored.
Absolutely. I think we're at time. We're going to take some questions. But I have one more question for you as we're doing. Come on up, and this will be short. What's the one thing you wish people who haven't taken psychedelics could know?
It's different than I thought it was. I mean, the experience, I'm describing the most kind of extreme point in the experience, but hours of the experience are less dramatic, and they're really meditative. And you enter this very interesting cognitive space. This is usually the denouement, as the experience is very, is beginning to end, where you just enter this very interesting cognitive space where you can choose to think about what you want to think about. And you can kind of do a work, a psychological work. And like, I'm going to think about my father now. And he'll be very present to you. And you can think about him in this incredibly focused, undistracted way. And I think that's a dimension of the psychedelic experience that doesn't get enough attention. And the other thing I would say is, these are powerful drugs. And they can be used in a reckless way, and that you have to pay a lot of attention to set and setting. And if you're at risk for serious psychological problems, things like schizophrenia, they're really not a good idea. And that being with a guide makes all the difference, especially as you get older. I think that we have more at stake as we get older, yet we have more to gain too, because we're locked, we're stuck. All of us. It's not just people who have cancer diagnoses or have addictions. We all have addictive behavior, and we all have habits of thought, destructive habits of thought, that we'd like to give up. And these drugs are very good for doing that kind of reset that doesn't happen late in life very often. So I think that's it's a beautiful metaphor. I'm just going to just very quickly do this, that one of the English researchers, actually he's Dutch, one of the scientists said, I was asking him, like, so what do you think's going on in the mind when this happens? How do people break habits? And he said, well, think of the mind as a hill covered in snow, and your thoughts are sleds going down. He's Dutch, so it would have been skis anywhere else, but they don't have mountains. And your thoughts are sleds going down the hill, and the more thoughts you have over time, the deeper the grooves that are formed in the snow, and after a while, it's very hard for the sled to go down without getting stuck in a groove. And what the psychedelics do is flatten the snow so that when you're sledding down, you can take a new path or many new paths. And I thought that was a beautiful, beautiful metaphor.
Absolutely.
Thanks for streaming this episode of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Michael Pollan is the author of How to Change Your Mind: What the New Science of Psychedelics Teaches Us About Consciousness, Dying, Addiction, Depression, and Transcendence. On his recent Seattle visit, he spoke with Ingrid K. Walker, an associate professor of American Studies at the University of Washington, Tacoma. She is the author of High, Drugs, Desire, and A Nation of Users. This conversation took place on May 22nd at Seattle's Temple de Hirsch Sinai. Town Hall Seattle presented the discussion. Thank you to KUOW's Jenny Cecil Moore for our recording. Again, you can hear the full event on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. Catch up with other great Seattle area talks by subscribing to our podcast. We do appreciate your likes and comments. Tune in again soon.